to do two other things. First, communicate with us. Tell us what you want, what you like, questions you'd like us to answer, things like that. We are open. We check every single email that comes in. We do get a great many of them, so we ask you to understand why we can't respond to all of them. But they are a way for us to learn how to better perform for you. And the second thing you can do is follow us on the social media. That is, through both websites, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and so on. Let me turn to the updates for today. I begin with two really short ones, but I think they're important. We are now at the annual celebration of International Women's Day. And since this is a program about economics, I thought I'd say a couple of words on that subject. Whatever advances women have made in the economic sphere of life, and there have been some advances in recent decades, nonetheless, the reality is that women still get less money for the exact same work that men are doing, for which there is no economic justification, let alone the moral and ethical dimensions. But even more important than that, I think, is the failure of our society and many, but particularly here in the United States, the failure to give women the kinds of support they need in our culture to pursue a career, to have a meaningful job outside the home. And the way to do that, of course, would be to provide high quality, highly secure childcare. Since we leave, as we still do as a society, the overwhelming bulk of the responsibility for childcare, and a good bit of that for elder care as well, on the backs of women, more than men, it behooves us as a society, if we're going to live that way, to at least give women the kinds of extra support that would allow them to have a chance at a job and a career commensurate with the contribution they could make. And if we don't do that, then we are giving them, in a sense, a double burden. The responsibility of childcare, et cetera, on the one hand, without the supports to allow a career on the other. And finally, I think economically, we do not recognize the enormous work women do in the household with childcare, with elder care, and with providing a huge amount of the emotional supports that everyone, particularly men, need. That's work that should be honored and recognized. For example, when we calculate the gross national product in our society, the total output in goods and services, why not do a reasonable estimate of all the work that women do in the household without being paid, but work that is nonetheless at least as valuable as a great deal of paid work? Why not give it the recognition of including it in our national statistics rather than the disrespect of excluding it? So there are a number of ways that while we think about International Women's Day, we might also want to think about the ways our economy could have and should have stepped up and provided the kinds of supports women deserve and women need, and the rest of our society needs just as much. The second brief item I want to bring to your attention is a sad one, but there is no way around it. At the end of last year, at the end of 2013, the Congress and the President could not agree to extend unemployment benefits. That's the extension of benefits beyond a basic period to take account of the fact that the current economic crisis since 2007 has seen unemployment last many weeks longer than the average since the Second World War. In other words, this crisis is bad, worse than most of them that we've had, and we've had about a dozen since the end of the Great Depression. It's worse in part because unemployment lasts so long. Instead of recognizing that and giving a helping hand to those who lost their job through no fault of their own and who are unemployed longer than normal through no fault of their own, the President and the Congress decided not to extend those benefits. Initially, it affected 1.4 million of our fellow citizens. Every week, tens of thousands more run out of their basic benefits and therefore are no longer eligible for extended benefits. Therefore, we recently crossed the two million mark. That is, 2 million of our fellow citizens have run out of unemployment benefits, even though they remain unemployed. You put that together with the recent cuts in food stamp support, and you get this revolting picture. There's really no nice word for this, in which we take those most needy amongst us, whose suffering really has nothing to do with the work they do, the skill they have, the millions who are unemployed because our employers aren't hiring, and we don't support them. Neither with food stamps anymore, nor with extended unemployment benefits. Something to think about in terms of your values. Turning to our usual updates, let's go through them quickly. An interesting website, which if you're not familiar with it, I urge you to take a look at, called the demandinstitute.org, did a recent expose and a study, research study, dividing American cities, in fact, the biggest 2,200 cities across the United States, and asked the question, are we dividing in a society not just between rich and poor citizens, but might we be dividing between rich and poor communities, cities, where most Americans live? And the answer is an unqualified yes. And I'm just going to give you one result of this remarkable study that you can find out more about, as I said, by going to demandinstitute.org. The top 10% of America's cities have over 50% of the value of the housing in our country. The bottom 60% of our cities, that's the majority of our cities, have only 17% of the value of housing. In other words, the United States is splitting more and more into rich cities and poor cities, matching what's happening among our citizens. The next update has to do with subsidies. The federal government, state governments, and local governments in the United States give subsidies to businesses. Most of the time, the explanation for this is that a business that's already there wants to stay there, so your government gives them a subsidy so the business doesn't move, doesn't leave City A to go to City B, doesn't leave State A to go to State B, doesn't leave the United States to go to another country. So the interesting question you might wonder is, who gets these subsidies? Are they equally distributed between enterprises large, medium, and small? Are they perhaps given to small and medium enterprises because they're the ones least likely to leave the United States in the first place, and they're the ones who kind of need the help to level the playing field in their competition with big business? Well, if you thought that, you'd be wrong. An outfit, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C., called Good Jobs First, .org, is if you want to follow this up, did a simple study and came up with the following. 3/4 of all the economic development dollars awarded and disclosed by state and local governments throughout the United States have gone to just 965 large corporations. That's right. The overwhelming bulk of subsidies go to where the money already is. To them that have shall be given. And to those who do not have, yea, even from them, something will be taken. I want to read you the names of some of the companies that have gotten the biggest share. Boeing Aircraft is by far the biggest. That's a fairly well-known story we've covered here before. Boeing has gone to the state of Washington, to the city of Seattle, and so on, and demanded huge subsidies and tax breaks, or else they're leaving to go to South Carolina, North Carolina, and so on. But there are many other companies. I want to list some of the biggest recipients of government subsidies. Alcoa, Intel, General Motors, Ford Motor. By the way, General Motors get billions in these subsidies. So in addition to being bailed out by the federal government in 2008, General Motors continues to get billions more in your tax money as it is paid to the states and cities as well as the federal government. Additional companies, huge companies, getting disproportionate numbers of subsidies. Dow Chemical, Berkshire Hathaway, Walmart stores, General Electric, Walgreens, and FedEx. If you want more details, as I say, go to goodjobsfirst.com. www.lawyerspeak.org, and you will get a sense of the ability of large corporations not only to pay less than the going tax rate paid by small and medium-sized companies, less than the tax rate paid by most individuals, but at the same time, their hands are out and they get the bulk of the subsidies paid for by the taxes, which they contribute to very little. If you ever wanted to wonder out loud who runs the United States government and who benefits from it, these statistics should answer your question. Next short update is a remarkable story from which an important lesson can be drawn. In this case, the players of the story are the Chrysler Automobile Company and the government of Canada. Chrysler got help in the dark days of 2008 and 9, both from the United States government and from the Canadian government. Once again, taxpayer money used, shoveled into the hands of a corporation to help the corporation through hard times. Wasn't it a surprise then when the Chrysler Corporation, a few weeks ago, went back to the Canadian government and asked again for more money, this time for subsidies to help their vans that are produced in Canada, many for shipment to the United States. But this time in Canada, backs had stiffened, and a number of local and regional politicians and local groups began to raise an alarm, saying, you know, this is outrageous. We've already subsidized Chrysler, and here they are a few years later, demanding money with vague or not so vague threats to move production to Mexico or elsewhere if we don't come across. So a hue and cry developed across Canada. And last week, and I wanted everyone to see and notice, Chrysler suddenly reversed itself, announced that, oh, they would continue to produce vans in Canada, thank you very much, no plans to move, and no need to give them a subsidy. Lesson. Many times when corporations demand subsidies, saying that they can't survive if they don't get them, or that they will go someplace else and thumb their nose at the country that refuses to give them a subsidy, if there's some backbone, if there's some pushback that says, no, 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 you can't keep demanding our tax money be used to help you, surprise, surprise, it turns out it was all a bluff after all. Chrysler in Canada, a case in point. Last two updates for today, short updates. This one has to do with a commentary in the New York Times by their frequent columnist, Thomas Friedman, this time entitled How to Get a Job at Google, appeared in the New York Times of February 23rd. And you don't know when you read this whether it's Mr. Friedman who's naive or the Google Corporation that's naive, and I'm not going to worry about which it is. Let's just tell the story. Mr. Friedman interviews a fellow named Laszlo Bock, senior vice president of people operations for Google. And this vice president at Google goes on and on about how GPAs are worthless when hiring somebody. GPA stands for grade point average, sort of how well you did in school to get it. And he very proudly says, you know, we have hired 14%, more than in the past, of people who don't have a college education. None at all. 14% of our employees. Well, that first caught my eye. Since half of Americans graduating half of Americans of that age graduating college haven't had any college. So if you were going to just hire people according to what proportion of the people have and don't have college educations, you'd be hiring 50% without college. Google hires 14%. That's not something I would boast a whole lot about if the point was we don't care that much about your college education. Obviously, they care a great deal. That should have made Mr. Friedman suspicious. It didn't. But then things got worse in the article. It was suggested by Mr. Bock that Google is very concerned to see about two other things in prospective employees. Are they capable of learning from failure? facing up to their failures and learning the lessons. And the other one was, it caught my eye, do they have a sense of ownership about their job and about the firm they work in? Because, you know, if you have a sense of ownership, the idea is, well, you'll care a lot. My reaction to this was to squint my eyes in disbelief. A worker should be open to learning from failure at Google. Wait a minute. A worker who fails at something, at Google or anywhere else, is in immediate danger of being fired. If you want to know why workers do not confront their failures, often do not even admit they had a failure, spend a lot of time blaming somebody else or something else, it's because if you admit a failure, which this Google character wants you to believe you ought to do, you're risking your own job. Unless and until corporations stop punishing people for failures, whether or not they are responsible for them, we're not going to have anything other than empty words about learning from failure. But the one that I really have to talk about is ownership. Google wants to hire people who will have a, quote, sense of ownership. I have a small piece of advice for Google and other employers. If you want workers to have a sense of ownership, give them some ownership. What are you saying? You want to deny workers any ownership of the company. You want to deny workers any control over the job. Workers don't participate in the decisions Google makes as to what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. You exclude your workers, and then you want to give them real good advice about having a sense of ownership. Give them ownership, they'll develop the sense all by themselves. For Google to say these things is astonishing. For the columnist at New York Times to take it seriously, that requires adjectives I don't want to use on the air. Finally, we all witnessed, I think, if we paid attention to the news over the last week or two, a remarkable drama in the state of Arizona. The governor there, Jan Brewer, finally decided, after much hoopla, to veto a bill passed by the Arizona legislature. This bill would have given businesses the right to discriminate against gay people if the owners or operators of the business had some sort of religious commitment that was critical of gay people, or that somehow they interpreted to mean that they can and should discriminate against gay people among their customers. When the legislature passed this bill, it was suddenly clear to a number of big corporations with activities in Arizona that they would suffer. Why? Understandably, gay people, being told that the state officially endorses the freedom of those who wish to discriminate against gays to do so in public places, restaurants, public service contracts, and so on, gay people wouldn't show up. In the past, major athletic and business events have been moved out of Arizona because people were so angry at this blatant kind of discrimination, which does not occur in most other states of the United States. So the big corporations began to weigh in and say, don't sign this, Governor Brewer, and even threatening, as businesses often do, that they would have to think about expanding in Arizona if this kind of thing passed, that they might move their operations out of Arizona, etc., etc. Predictably, once the big corporations weighed in, and once it was an overwhelming number of corporations with virtually no corporation pushing the other way, predictably the politician caved. And this big, bold Jan Brewer did what the companies told her to do, and she vetoed the bill. For me, the lesson here is not how nice it is for gay folks to have some support from big corporations. That's what the media focused on. I'm more interested in the lesson to be learned. When corporations, in overwhelming majorities, feel strongly, American politicians do what they want, do what they're told by these large corporations. And if you think large corporations may have some trouble getting their acts together for a unanimity around an issue of discrimination against gay people, believe me, they have no problem getting together about blocking any kinds of legislation that help labor at the expense of business, that help wages at the expense of profits. So if you're looking and applauding at what happened in Arizona, keep an eye out for the other lesson there, that corporations in this culture get what they want. And when they're all unified, as corporations are, about boosting profits and not taking care of the mass of their working people, that's when the politicians really roll over and do what they're told. Let me turn now, as we often do, in fact, as we always do, to some of the larger discussions that we have. And I wanted to begin this one by commenting on the first public speech given last week by Ben Bernanke, the recently departed head of the Federal Reserve Bank, a person we have talked about often on this program. He's no longer the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, and one of the things he's doing is typical of people who used to be on the Federal Reserve Bank. He circulates around, we call that the lecture circuit, where he is paid huge amounts of money, now that he's a famous ex-head of the Federal Reserve, to give speeches. And not surprisingly, these kinds of lectures go first to where the money is the biggest to pay for their words of wisdom. So now we find Ben Bernanke where? In Abu Dhabi, in the Middle East, giving the first public speech since he stepped down from the head of the Federal Reserve. And what did Mr. Bernanke have to say? The headline in the Bloomberg news coverage of this event that happened on the 4th of March, Bloomberg, was that he was regretful at Main Street's view of his Federal Reserve's bailout of the huge banks and other financial industries of the United States. He was sorry that they were angry because they, he meant Main Street, the average American city, the average American citizen, they were angry, he recognized, because they didn't get much help from the Federal Reserve. Not much help meaning like none directly. So here now are Ben Bernanke's words. Quote, "My natural inclination, even if it weren't for the legal mandate, would be to try to help the average person." End quote. That's Mr. Bernanke. Now listen to the next sentence. "The complexity arises because in order to help the average person, you have to do things, dash, very distasteful things, dash, like try to prevent some large financial companies from collapsing." Okay, let's turn this into plain English. Mr. Bernanke wants the mass of people who feel aggrieved that the Federal Reserve didn't help them directly, but only helped big corporations, to understand that he didn't really want to. He just had to, because the way you help the average person, it turns out, is to help the huge financial corporation, even if its behavior helped to bring on the very crisis that afflicts us all. And now here's the punchline. The remark, and this is a quotation from the Bloomberg service on the Abu Dhabi speech of Mr. Bernanke. This is the sentence you really have to engrave on your wall and look at once a week, just so you believe it. Quote, "By preventing the system from collapsing, we're protecting the economy. We're protecting you." That he's talking to the average American, you and me. "By preserving the system, by preventing it from collapsing." What is Mr. Bernanke telling us? Do we have a system that divides rich and poor in ways we haven't seen for a century? Yes. Do we have a system that periodically collapses and sometimes severely, as in the years since 2007? Yes. Do we have a system that primarily bails out the very richest corporations whose speculations brought us this crisis? Yes. And do we have a Federal Reserve that prevents that system from collapsing further by rewarding the richest enterprises who brought us the crisis with the bulk of the direct bailout? The answer, Mr. Bernanke, by his actions and even by his words, is yes, 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 that's what we do. Okay, are we surprised? No. But let's make the comment that's obvious and in order here. A system like that doesn't deserve to be preserved. A system like that deserves to be criticized for working in those ways. Preserving that system is not the only way to respond to such a grotesque failure. In fact, the best way to respond is to question that system, to debate whether the best response to this system's umpteenth failure might be to change the system rather than fixing it once again in ways we've learned don't work. But such thoughts never occur to Mr. Bernanke. For him, preventing the collapse of this system, no matter how unfair the bailout is the preferred, the necessary way to go. No thought in his mind that there's a problem with our system. It's an unthinkable thought. And that's why money was given out, huge trillions, to the big banks. Who else could that money have been given out to? Well, we know the big banks didn't do what the government hoped. The Federal Reserve gave them big bailouts in the hopes that they would turn around and use that money to make loans to individuals and businesses, large and small, to get the economy going again. They didn't do it, the banks. Oh, they took the money from the Federal Reserve, but they played on the stock market with it. They hoarded it. They didn't spend it. Here's an alternative, Mr. Bernanke, you might not have thought of. Set up government banks and then give the Federal Reserve the order. You give the money to those banks with the order, which the government could impose, that be lent out to businesses. Then we wouldn't have had the problem we had with the private banking system that you, Mr. Bernanke, could not imagine any alternative to. How about giving money to the mass of people so that they spend it and that rebuilds the American economy? Not from the top down with big finance firms, but from the bottom up with people and small and medium businesses with money in their pocket to borrow, to spend, to loan, and to rebuild the economy. That's unorthodox. You did unorthodox things too. You're proud of those you did. They all have one quality. They benefited those at the top and they left everybody out. You regret that the mass of people feel badly about what you did? The only solution to that, Mr. Bernanke, is to have behaved differently, not to regret the perception of the mass of people. They saw the problem perfectly clearly. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to remind you, as we often do, that we have two websites that we maintain for your use that contain more information about the topics we're covering today, as well as many, many other bits of information you may find useful. There are also classes and lectures and interviews and audio files and all kinds of material, videos that you will find of interest. The websites are both available to you without any charge, 24/7. rdwolf.com is one, and democracyatwork.info is the other. Not only can you find the information there, but you can also communicate to us, which we welcome you to do, and you can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest by clicking on those icons at either of those two websites. The next big issue I want to discuss is important. We've discussed it before, but we can go into further detail about it now, thanks to a recent paper written for and posted by the International Monetary Fund, a single most important institution dealing with the monetary system of the whole world, the IMF, as it's generally known. And it is a creature of governments and the biggest banking institutions, hardly a friend of labor, hardly a friend of those critical of capitalism. And that's why its paper is so intrinsically important for us. So the paper has two authors, Jonathan Ostry, O-S-T-R-Y, and Andrew Berg, B-E-R-G. And you can find this work at the following website, blog-imfdirect.imf.org. Okay, what is this paper about, and why is it so important that I want to devote time to it? Traditionally, in economics, the conservative perspective has been able to establish an idea that has been around a long time. Here's how the idea works. That there is a trade-off in economics, in the way economies work. Either you have rapid economic growth, or you have equality. That is, if you want the economy to grow, you have to pay the price of inequality, of a large number of people having relatively little and a small number of people having a great deal. The basic crude idea here is if a small number of people have a great deal, well, they'll be willing not to consume all of that because they have so much, and they will make some of it available of their so much as an investment to enable companies to have wealth with which to hire more workers, buy more equipment, and produce more. In other words, inequality enables economic growth. Now, of course, you shouldn't be surprised that conservatives love this idea because it's a way of suggesting that their inordinate wealth, the concentration of wealth, the inequality of wealth, is somehow going to benefit the people who don't have wealth because the economy will grow more quickly and somehow it'll, here we go again, trickle down to the mass of people. Never mind that the trickle either never happens or doesn't last for very long. So here comes then the paper of Ostry and Berg. They decide to use the latest available data to look at long periods of history and at many different countries' experiences. Basically, they're doing what we call an empirical test, looking at the facts, asking this question: when and where countries established redistribution policies. In other words, they took wealth from the rich and spread it more out among the middle and the bottom. When they created, by intention, less inequality, did it indeed reduce the economic growth of that economy? In other words, is the trade-off true? Is it the case, country by country, historical period by historical period, is it the case that when we have made things more equal, we have had to pay the price of a slower rate of economic growth? And their answer, and let me underscore this as strongly as I know how, their answer is an unequivocal no. That is, the historical record shows that redistribution of wealth and income, shifting it from those who have most of it to the middle and lower classes who have relatively much less, this kind of greater equality achieved by redistribution turns out not to have slowed economic growth, not at all. And that's true in different historical periods, and it's true across many different countries. So that even if you allow for the special circumstances that exist in each historical period and in each country, since they are different one from the other, even allowing for that, the overall data do not support the idea that we need to pay the price of inequality to get economic growth. And that removes one of the few remaining efforts of the super rich to try to make an argument that their having so much is somehow, magic, magic, good for everybody. It isn't. Well, what does this suggest? It suggests that when liberal or leftist political leaders around the world champion redistribution, a tax system, for example, that takes from the rich in order to redistribute it to the middle and the lower, that pays a different kind of wage system so that much less in the way of wages and salaries go to the upper levels and more to the middle and the bottom. Whatever the mode of redistributing wealth may be, if its goal and if its result is greater equality, it turns out that we have just as much economic growth and sometimes more than we would have had if we left things unequal. So that exposes the argument for the bogus justification of inequality that it always was. And who's done the work? The International Monetary Fund. Who published the paper with the results? The International Monetary Fund. Oh, wow. Now, what does that mean? What lessons do we draw from this remarkable piece of research? Well, I think it's the following. That redistribution is justified. It produces greater equality, and the justification for that has to do with political life. Our chances of having a political democracy are much greater if we have economic equality to undergird it. If everybody has roughly equal chances economically, then they will equally be able to participate politically. But if a few people have an enormous amount of money to play in elections, to play on influencing people, and the mass of people don't, that's not a good situation for democracy, to say the least. So greater equality has justifications on moral grounds, on ethical grounds, on the grounds of a commitment to political democracy. But what this paper shows is that greater equality is also justified economically, that it doesn't sacrifice economic growth. Indeed, one of the side results of their research was to show that sometimes greater inequality can produce a spurt of growth. That's their argument. But it's not sustained. In other words, you get a sudden spurt because rich people are excited about how much richer they're becoming. But as soon as that kind of settles in, they discover that now that the mass of people don't have as much because the rich got richer, they can't buy the company's output that those rich folks control. And so it isn't sustained. The inequality gives you a spurt, but it peters out. That's sort of what we're in now, petering out, because it's not sustainable, the kind of growth we had in the 1990s when inequality exploded in the United States. So it turns out, economically too, it's better to have the kind of equality we're not seeing in the United States, and we're not seeing in Europe, and we're not seeing in a large part of the world. Here's the irony. We are sacrificing economic growth by preserving extraordinary levels of inequality. After all, that's what 20 million unemployed people means. We're not growing because 20 million of our people who want jobs, who could have the jobs because we're not using a fifth of our tools, equipment, and raw materials. Of course we're not growing because we're wasting human beings who want to work, and we're wasting the tools, equipment, and raw materials they would need to work with. We are sacrificing growth, and the growth we're sacrificing is because we are so unequal. Last comment. How do you get equality if indeed it's better morally, ethically, politically, and now we see economically too? Well, one way is redistribution. Once the goods and services are distributed, the government steps in and redistributes them, moves them from the rich to the poor, from the rich to the middle, and so on. But you know, that always produces tension, anger, resentment, conflict. Here's a thought. Rather than redistribution to get equality, why don't we avoid redistribution by distributing goods and services more equally, by distributing income more equally in the first place. If we did that, we wouldn't then have to redistribute it later. And how would we accomplish that? Well, those of you who are familiar with this program will not be surprised by the answer I offer. The biggest source of unequal income, producing the inequality of wealth that invites redistribution, the biggest source of inequality is how the enterprises that produce the goods and services in the United States, how they distribute their profits. So take your average large corporation. The decision about how to distribute profits is made by the board of directors, 15 to 20 people at the top, and the major shareholders of the company, another dozen or so folks. Indeed, those are the dozen who select the board of directors. So it's really the same group. Those 20, 30 people, they decide. Now, guess what? They typically distribute the profits in two major forms: dividends, which go to the shareholders, and top executive salaries, which go to the top members of the board of directors and the top managers. In other words, they're the ones whose decisions how to distribute the profits are what create inequality. That has to be understood. The folks at the top of our economic system grab the bulk of the profits. Now, let's be clear. Who produces the profits of a corporation? Answer: everybody in it. All the workers, from the smallest to the biggest, from the most educated to the less educated, everybody plays his or her role in making the corporation succeed. And yet, the decision about how to use the profits everybody helps to produce are made by a tiny group of people who, surprise, surprise, reward themselves. If we didn't organize corporations this way, we wouldn't end up with the inequality in our society that invites debates and struggles over redistribution. If we made corporations democratic, if all the people together had an equal say in what to do with the profits that they all help to produce, guess what? Average decision-making by everybody democratically, one person, one vote, would, of course, distribute those profits much less unequally than boards of directors and major shareholders now do. We wouldn't need redistribution because then we would have a much more equitable distribution in the first place. Would everybody get the same? I don't think so. I think workers reasonably would pay more to some and less to others in response to all kinds of considerations. But the one thing we can be sure of is they wouldn't give tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to a few top executives. They wouldn't pay out huge portions of the profits to shareholders who had relatively nothing to do with producing those profits, or very little. We wouldn't have to struggle over redistribution because we had made a more equitable distribution in the first place. And now with this paper by Ostry and Berg for the IMF, we know that greater equality achieved by democratizing an enterprise would not, in fact, have a negative impact on economic growth, because the redistributions that have happened periodically through history did not have that effect that conservatives had wanted us to believe with them, because they needed so badly to have an argument about why their inordinate wealth was somehow socially useful. Okay, I wanted to turn now, as we often do at this part of the program, to questions that you have sent in. And as always, I do need to say to you, Please bear with us. We get many, many more questions than we can possibly answer. We are very grateful for the questions you sent in. We do use them to shape the program. We simply cannot, however, answer them all. And there are now so many, we can't even answer them in email responses, although we still try to do some of that some of the time. Okay, the first question is, you are an advocate of worker self-directed enterprises, worker co-ops. But let me ask you a blunt question. How can we be sure that those kinds of enterprises won't take the kinds of self-serving steps that capitalist corporations do, making profits at the expense of the worker, of the consumer? Even if workers took over, they might not take advantage of themselves, but wouldn't they still be tempted, to take advantage of the consumer, to do things that help them at the expense of the general public? Let me answer this way. Is that a danger? Sure it is. Will there need to be steps to make sure that we identify and end any practice in which a collective of workers who run their own enterprise make decisions that would be inimical, not good for the public? But I think the best way to do that, which perhaps your question could have addressed, and that is part of my answer, is that we're not likely to have a transition economically from the capitalist system we have now with the top-down, undemocratic enterprise organization that is our norm. We're not likely to have a transition from that to worker self-directed enterprises without there also being all other kinds of changes happening more or less at the same time. One of those changes, I think, will be and will have to be a kind of economic planning that private enterprises have always been afraid to allow the government to do. The reason private capitalist enterprises are afraid of government planning is not because of some abstract philosophical commitment against planning. If you know how most large corporations work, they plan everything down to the last detail inside their corporation, and they're proud of it and devote enormous resources to it. Planning is not the problem. The problem is they don't want to give power to a government. Why? Because in democratic societies, the government, in the end, is elected by the mass of people. And private corporations are very nervous when the mass of people have some power, out of fear that that power could be used to advance the interests of the mass of people against the interests of private capitalists. They rather have less help from the government and keep it weak, poor, dependent, than give it the power that could at some point be used in ways that frighten them. Well, if we didn't have private capitalists, we wouldn't need to have this fear of the government. And I suspect what would happen is that the government would indeed be not only entitled to, but would be required to do planning. And the first kind of planning is the planning needed to give everybody who's able and willing to work a job. Because it is irrational in society not to do that. We need people who have the creativity to apply it, to produce things for all of us. If we have more people than we need output, then give everybody a shorter workday. But give everybody a job as a matter of right. If we believe in our society that you ought to be able to get a public education as a matter of right, that you ought to have a park nearby where you can have recreation and walk your dog and play with your kids as a matter of your right as a citizen, etc., then we also ought to say that having a job, earning an income, feeling good about yourself is a basic right. Just like the Second Bill of Rights that FDR proposed in 1944, every person has a right to a job. Suppose we gave the government the planning authority to make sure everybody's working, to move people from where the jobs are shrinking to where the jobs are growing. to provide them with funds to see them through the transition, to help them pay for the travel that might be necessary if a job is in a different place. And when the private sector or individual enterprises don't have enough jobs, the government can always identify things that need to be done in the community and jobs that will go with getting those things done. The reason I stress this is, one of the major reasons we might fear that corporations owned and operated by their own workers might take steps that are not good for the public if they're fearful for jobs. That's, after all, why so much of what goes wrong in capitalism happens, because companies fear for their profits and job owners fear for losing their job, whether they're corporate executives or middle management or workers. One of the best ways to deal with the problem of mistakes and bad decisions coming from anxiety over a job is to remove the anxiety. Will there be some people who then coast? Surely. But I think the social costs of the coasting workers is a lot less than the social cost we have been paying for people making decisions fearful for losing their jobs. We should separate the decisions that are best for our economy from the anxiety over job loss. Last question that we'll have time for. Why do federal, state, and local governments hire contractors rather than using their own public employees? This is a very important question. The basic idea of public employees doing all kinds of things, teaching school, collecting the garbage, being your firefighter, and so on, is very simple. These are public services that everybody, or nearly everybody, uses. And if public employees do them, then the only cost of providing those services is to pay the employee and to provide him and her with the tools and equipment to do the job. If a public employee does it, no profit needs to be earned on it. By contrast, if a private enterprise does those things, it needs not only to pay workers and to pay for the tools and equipment and raw materials needed to do the job, but the company has to earn a profit on top of it. Basic idea, if private enterprises do it, it'll cost us more in tax money than if we have public employees do it. That was the basic idea. And that's why public services were established. And that basic idea has as much validity today as it always did. The problem, of course, is that it may become a situation where public employees have unions and develop union jobs that are paid reasonably well, whereas private contractors can get out of union jobs, can break their unions, and can pay people much less than what unions get, and therefore offer to do the job, still earning a profit, but paying people a lot less. Bottom line, typically if you pay people a lot less, the quality of the public service deteriorates. And so periodically, when private enterprises take over, there's an anger in the public and we go back to public employees. And then we oscillate back and forth. It's not good for anybody. It's inefficient. It doesn't solve the problem. Here's a solution. Make public services something that workers themselves, who are public employees, control. Make the public have an oversight. Together, those two can do a better job than the oscillation between public and private that has troubled our public sector for so long. Thank you very much for being with me today. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update.
But after a while, it's gonna be my time, baby.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.fm under Community Events.
It's just about 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a report from Fukushima 3 years after the meltdown and tsunami there. We hear about a new report suggesting that people living around a nuclear reactor in California are suffering negative health impacts, and journalist Robert Perry talks about the real politics driving the Ukraine and the U.S. involvements in what may have been a soft coup. At 11 o'clock, stay tuned for The Dirtbag. Host Glenn Andreessen will speak with gardening book author Maggie Stuckey about growing vegetables in containers. We have one short announcement, and then Air Cascadia. Oh, no, I just played that announcement. Let's hear a little music before we go to Air Cascadia. Thank you for tuning in today.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, March 12th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. A lot of headlines today, and we are going to talk with Noel Hanrahan with the Prison Radio Project about the curious reporting on Mumia Abu-Jamal. Coming on the heels of remarks yesterday regarding the manner in which news out of Venezuela has been reported in the American press. Extraordinary distortions of fact, should we call it that? And in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and the Justice Department appointee, Civil Rights Division appointee, the manner in which mainstream media and even media which aspires to lean slightly to the left or likes to consider itself to be slightly more community-minded, even these media outlets have completely neglected the fact that it's been virtually proved that Mumia didn't kill a policeman. Furthermore, the term cop killer has been used in a reckless and irresponsible way, which a professional journalist would never use. Tossing that term around, all right, New York Daily News maybe, or tabloids, that sort of thing. Yeah, okay, we don't necessarily condone it, but we don't use it. And yet, on no less than National Public Radio, I'll go right out and say it, the term cop killer has been used frequently referring to Mumia Abu-Jamal. Maybe their anchor was having a bit of a struggle to pronounce his names. They're notoriously bad with foreign names, so that could possibly be one explanation. And Edward Snowden at South by Southwest, shaking things up, the quote, governments have stopped talking about the public interest and started talking about the national interest. And when these diverge, something is wrong. Snowden states absolutely, firmly and categorically, would I do this again? Absolutely, yes. No matter what happens to me, I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and I saw it was being violated on a mass scale. Go, Edwin. You are definitely the hero of this era. And the National Security Agency was blocked by a judge, as we noted yesterday, from carrying out plans to begin destroying phone records collected for surveillance after a privacy group argued that they're relevant to lawsuits, claiming the practice is unconstitutional. Isn't it funny, though, however, Dianne Feinstein has done a complete 180 on this when it turns out that it's her own communications which have been spied upon. The NFIB, anybody ever heard of it? The National Federation for Independent Business. I have. I had a visit from them. They came to my house and presented their argument that they stood up for small business. If you ever have a visitation from one of the representatives, head for the hills, run. They're not a mom and pop unless the kids turn out to be the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers, backed this group, the NFIB, gave millions to small business, the lobbyists and affiliated groups, to the tune of $2.5 million from Freedom Partners. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, of course, would be the parent of the whole enterprise. It's a conservative advocacy group with deep ties to the Koch empire, and of the five men that sit on the group's board, four are current or former employees of Koch companies, and one is a close personal friend of Charles Koch. Freedom Partners gave the NFIB $1.5 million last year, the biggest single contribution the Federation received. All these numbers are coming straight from tax records. There are other reports. The Koch-backed group, though, gave three other NFIB-affiliated groups another $1 million, making the Freedom Partners among the top two biggest contributors to the NFIB. Now, this is supposed to be a small business advocacy organization. Take a look at some of their positions. And as far as environmental issues go, they are abysmal. It simply does not get any worse. And yet none of that is presented as part of their platform when they come calling and knocking. They actually made tea for these people. And there's something very wrong with the official story about the Boston bombings. There are gaping holes in the story about the largest alleged terrorist attack.